Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Lorena was not invited back to the Stallworth residence for several weeks. She sensed Jenny was angry about the camping trip and accepted this without complaint. Perhaps it was better that she returned to the safe boundaries of her life. Still, at night, she thought of Mr. Stallworth in the desert, under the stars. She felt his hands gripping her calves. She saw the scorpions. They seemed somehow his, sprinkled across the floor of the desert like a constellation. What made them glow under UV light? It was a mystery that felt bound up in the mystery of him.
That's Steve Almond reading an excerpt from his novel, All the Secrets of the World. Steve has written 12 books of fiction and nonfiction, including the New York Times bestsellers Candy Freak and Against Football. You may know him as the co-host of the popular advice podcast, Dear Sugars, with Cheryl Strayed. Now, with All the Secrets of the World, Steve's officially a novelist. It took him 30 years to write it, but I can assure you, it's definitely worth the wait. All the Secrets of the World is a propulsive narrative about two teenage girls whose friendship pulls their very different families into a web of secrets and lies. Steve tackles a range of subjects in the book, including astronomy, scorpion biology, tabloid journalism, and FBI interrogation techniques. And the book is a shapeshifter, morphing from one genre to another to yet another. Steve joins us now to share some of the secrets of his genre-bending work.
In trying to describe the book to people, I kept saying, well, how do I do this? Because it's written in a number of different styles, and it moves from really a story about a young woman and kind of her world expanding in ways that are terribly exciting but also very dangerous, to police procedural, and then it moves out into the desert, and those sort of plot strands come together, but they do so in a way that has a very propulsive what's going to happen next. Every scene is throwing you forward into the next scene. And that's good. That's what a plot should do. Back to Aristotle and the Poetics, you know, there should be a chain of consequence. Not this happened and this happened and this happened, but this happened and therefore this happened. And because of that, this next thing's going to happen. That's the thrill of plot. But I'm not good at plot, Doug. That's not my thing. I'm sort of a person who's interested in people's inner lives, their thoughts and ruminations. So it was really hard to explain to people. I apparently have written a thriller, but it's a thriller that's very concerned with that ancient story of what happens when somebody who's powerless collides with the world of power. That's what's happening with Lorena and the Stallworths. It's a powerful family colliding with a family that's virtually powerless. And that's really the province of the social novel, back to Hugo and Dickens, and in the American tradition to Passos and Steinbeck. And that's the story of kind of the larger systems of power in which the individuals are trapped. Furthermore, as you know, Doug, the book is also stuffed full of all this other stuff that had been rattling around my subconscious for 30 years. Scorpion biology, and the Reagans are in there, Nancy Reagan, and astrology and astronomy, and there's a Mormon sex cult. It's kind of nuts.
Yeah, but that's one of the most compelling aspects of it, I think. The way it mutates from one genre to another, it's just really, really fascinating. Let's talk about the opening of the story. It begins in Sacramento in 1981, and we meet these two 13-year-old girls, Lorena Sines and Jenny Stallworth. Can you tell us a bit more about them?
Lorena is fiercely intelligent. She's really smart, but she comes from a family. Her mother's undocumented. And her brother is undocumented. Her father, who's no longer in the picture, is also undocumented. In fact, they came to the United States partly so that she could be born in the United States, so that she would have a better shake in things. Her mother's from Honduras. Her father's from El Salvador. In a sense, she was a dreamer before we had that name. In fact, she's an American citizen, but the way that she moves through life is similar to a dreamer in the sense that she's constantly worried that if she does something or calls attention to herself or gets in any kind of trouble, becomes visible in any way, that her family might be deported. So she lives in this kind of constant terror, but she's also a 13-year-old young woman who is fiercely intelligent and ambitious. She's very hungry to be seen. She's very hungry to have the world recognize that. And as the book opens, she's paired with the most glamorous and beautiful classmate and her class, Jenny Stallworth, on a science project, and this brings her into the orbit of the Stallworth family, who are this wealthy white family, and into their home. And immediately, both Stallworth parents take an unnatural interest in her for different reasons. And she sort of gets sucked into the vortex of this family that's full of all these illicit urges and secrets that they're keeping from everyone. And I have to say, it's just delicious to write about family dysfunction, having a character come in from the outside and sort of realize, oh my God, this is a house of freaks. And furthermore, I find it very exciting to be here.
Yeah. How did you get into the heads of these two 13-year-old girls? Because you do like a remarkable job of capturing what, you know, they're very realistic and very authentic characters.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I was 13 years old in 1981. And I remember a lot of the events that I recount here, the dawn of the Reagan Revolution, Reagan's assassination attempt, and even moving into the homes of families that I knew had more money than me, that were more glamorous and more assured. And so that felt very familiar to me. I believe that if you peel back everybody's adult behaviors and, you know, their sort of therapized yoga breathing selves, you'll find an adolescent. We're all kind of the most alive at that age, the most hopeful and the most sort of slavish for attention and regard. And so for me, that does not live very far beneath the surface. So for me to go into the minds and hearts was really just like taking a trip back into my adolescence, which is still with me in many ways.
Jenny's father, Marcus, and Lorena bond over scorpions. Can you tell us a bit about their relationship and the role it plays in your story without revealing any spoilers?
Marcus Stallworth is a scorpiologist, and one of the first things he does is take his kids, including Lorena, out into the desert, and he turns on an ultraviolet lamp, and all of a sudden, the desert floor, which had seemed empty, comes alive. There are literally hundreds of glow-in-the-dark. They look like the sort of toys that they used to put in cereal boxes, kind of, you know, the glowing animal of some kind, and then they start moving. And these, of course, are the scorpions who, for reasons that scientists still don't understand, fluoresce under ultraviolet light. And then Marcus picks one up, a species that's not too dangerous, and then, you know, Lorena actually wants to handle one as well. And the moment that animal comes onto her skin, there's just this incredible sense of excitement and danger that sort of stands in for the larger danger of moving into the Marcus Stallworth world. And I think they're both curious. They both see the human world as full of deceit, and they see the animal world as a more natural and honest world. I think of Marcus Stallworth in some ways as like a scorpion. He can seem from certain angles predatory, but yes, there's another part of him that's actually very frightened and very aware of the danger of his impulses and trying to hold them in check. He's trying to constantly retreat and scurry away from Lorena, and she continues to pursue him. So I was interested in that, and I'll just confess that as a young reporter, I was taken into the desert by a couple of scorpiologists, and they flipped on this ultraviolet lamp, and I was the one who saw 30 years ago the desert floor come alive, and I never forgot it. That's why it went into the book.
Interesting. There's also a lot of social commentary in your novel. Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan are recurring characters, and you also explore tabloid journalism, immigration, and FBI interrogation techniques. What part do these elements play in all of the secrets of the world?
Well, it is this thing we call a social novel. And in a social novel, what you're trying to do is dramatize how a bunch of characters in different positions in the culture with different amounts of power, how they collide and what happens when they collide. And in order to do that, you really have to be able to investigate the larger systems of power that people operate within. So when there's an alleged abduction and the police start investigating, I felt it was my responsibility to be able to be realistic in the way that I portrayed a police officer in making this, you know, launching his investigation. I think the social novel is trying ultimately to make sure that nobody gets flattened into a caricature. Nobody becomes purely a victim or a villain. Somebody like Lorena is certainly a victim in many cases because she doesn't have the power, but she's also complicit in certain ways in the story that unfolds, and she recognizes that. The same thing is true of somebody like Nancy Reagan. She's monstrously naive, and her actions have unintended consequences that are terrible and tragic. But she is also, as I felt and thought my way more deeply into her psyche and her heart, she's also a wife who adores her husband, and she sees him get shot, and she's desperate to keep him safe, even if that means adopting astrology as some kind of magical belief system that will keep Ronnie from getting shot again or harmed. So I really felt by the end of the book, Doug, like I wanted to understand everybody's point of view and everybody's set of incentives so that they didn't wind up, you know, you couldn't look at this and say, oh, what a terrible injustice, but that you would look at it and say, boy, how complicated human beings are and how complicated human systems of power are and how heartbreaking when people who are innocent are caught up in something and ultimately are treated as if they're guilty.
Mm-hmm. And that makes the book all the more powerful as a result. So thank you for doing that. All the Secrets of the World has been optioned to be turned into a TV series. Can you tell us about this?
Well, one of the other things that was happening when I was sending the book out to initial readers is they were saying, sometimes with a feeling of being quite shocked, like, this is like a movie. Like, I can see everything. The scorpions out in the desert. I can see the inside of the Stalwart's house. I can see this charged moment between these two characters, the teenagers in the swimming pool at night with the flickering blue light. I can see it. It's like a movie, people would say to me. And I was like, yeah, I'm as shocked as anybody. I'm not used to writing pieces that people view as cinematic. And sure enough, pretty quickly, you know, a film agent got a hold of it and read it. And before I knew it, I was in this bizarre Zoom with like 9 different people from 7 different movie companies talking about how excited they were to try to turn this into a series. And I was just delighted. So I'm super psyched. If John Feldman, who's the writer, who's worked on a Newsroom and The Wonder Years, a bunch of shows that I really love. And we talked about the book and I was like, this guy totally gets what I'm up to. Mm-hmm. And any way that I can help him make the TV show, I am here for it.
Mm. Your parents are both psychoanalysts, and when you were battling depression many years ago, your dad urged you to get into psychoanalysis. What kind of impact did psychoanalysis have on you, if you don't mind asking?
No, I guess it's all out there now. but, I mean, I'm glad to have you ask a question like that, because I think sometimes people are embarrassed to talk about having mental health issues or needing therapeutic support in some way. And it's the way I think of it, Doug, is everybody deserves therapy, but not everybody can get it because it's expensive in various different ways. And it's also frightening. But for me at that time, I didn't really understand the parts of me that felt broken or stuck in some way. And to be honest, a lot of my preoccupation had to do with like, when am I going to be able to write a novel? Oh my God, I can't write a novel, or I can't succeed in the way I want to as an artist. And the truth is that that's a very cruel way for me to have been treating myself. I couldn't have helped it, but sometimes the central job of a good therapy is to get human beings focused on what matters, which is to esteem who you are and what you're doing. Not to say, oh, I haven't done enough, but to say, here's what I'm up to. And sometimes it feels like I'm overmatched by the things I'm trying to do, but I'm trying. And I think that's the way in which this analysis was helpful for me. It also hipped me to certain patterns that I have that helped me understand why I was overreacting to certain situations, why I was engineering certain kinds of disaster in my relationships. It didn't make me all better, but it made me better. And I'm very grateful to have spent the time and energy investigating my inner life. It's all in there looking for a way out, as Nick Hornby says. And I love that line, because that's what all the Secrets of the World is trying to say. If you're keeping secrets from the world and you're keeping secrets from yourself, something is going to end badly. There's going to be a crash. There's going to be a tragedy, because human beings, I think, are quite burdened by the parts of themselves that they cannot confess and seek comfort and company from other human beings in their lives around. And so I think of all the secrets in the world, or at least Lorena, where she begins and where she ends the book, as really a testament to somebody who figures that out and finds a way to persevere because of her tremendous intelligence, but also just her emotional and her psychological strength. I know that people have told me that the book has elements that are very dark, but I think of it ultimately as hopeful because Lorena's able to persevere and able to help one of her students unburden themselves of a secret and feel less alone. And that to me feels like a real happy ending.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with you on that. Steve Almond, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on All the Secrets of the World. I hope we don't have to wait 30 years to read your next novel.
That makes two of us, Doug. I really hope it does not take another 30 years. It was great talking with you.
Steve Almond is the author of the novel All the Secrets of the World. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Emily St. John Mandel, Gorman Bichard, and Steve Almond. Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Don't forget to offer a rating or to share your favorite show with new alphas. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Because I hear you've been worse than usual this morning. I didn't think that was possible, so I've been dispatched as the Steve Whisperer.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I'm here to talk with Friedrich, or Freddie, if he prefers.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
See, this is why the tape keeps going, Doug. The little things like that. That's why we keep the tape rolling.